GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by Mira Software Services, 1,500 software professionals specializing in the areas of software-defined networking, evolved packet core, and more. Details at mera.biz or 650-479-5350.
It is Saturday, March 22nd, 2014. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org. And it's time now for Geek Speak.
We're through being cool. We're through being cool. Eliminate the minis and the twins.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the Geeks affiliated organizations. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch in the host chair today, and with me in the studio is Ben Jaffe, a web development instructor, musician, and world traveler. Hello, Ben.
Hello.
And also Lindsay Lonnie, a systems analyst and web programmer.
Good morning.
Welcome back. It's been a little while, yeah?
It has.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You've been doing all right?
I have. I've been doing great. Thanks.
Good. Well, that's what counts. Well, lots to talk about today. My gosh, things have been happening, and we're just going to dive right into it with face recognition, Ben.
So I'm not sure whether to consider this creepy or really technically awesome.
Oh, I'll be the judge.
You'll be the judge. So basically, Facebook has been really banking on this form of artificial intelligence known as deep learning. In a nutshell, it simulates these different layers of neurons and feeds it tons and tons of information, kind of like the way babies learn, right? You just mm-hmm. feed them tons of information and eventually they discern patterns. Mm-hmm. Well, what they're using this for is facial recognition. So you take a whole bunch of pictures of people, of let's say a single person from different angles and everything, and their software that they just released a research paper on can actually match faces almost as well as you do.
What do you mean? Wait a minute. Like, I'm pretty good.
The human brain is a pretty good tool for things like that.
It's extremely good, yeah. So 97.53%, that's about how good you guys are.
Really?
You get it 97.53% of the time.
I'm proud of all of us.
Facebook gets 97.25%.
Wait a minute now.
How did they do that?
It's like a quarter of a percent less than how well we can do.
Please tell me it's not like a Facebook AI out there somewhere.
Yeah, so
Facebook, that's what I just started thinking about. Is like, oh, this is now, you know, the Terminator is going to be able to go, yep, that's him.
Yeah.
You can picture a little bar. Yeah.
Well, a couple things. First of all, wow, that's phenomenal. You know, yeah. Like machine learning has never been even close to, like, especially things like facial recognition or image processing, not even nearly as close as humans can get.
But based on how many other photos, right? They're drawing from all the other images out there of a person that are tagged. True?
Yeah, that's definitely true. So like if I see one picture of somebody or if I just meet someone really briefly and then I go and I look at some photos, I'm going to be able to do that really well. Maybe the machine learning can't do that so well because it doesn't have a huge data set to learn from. Mm-hmm. It's going to do better than they've been able to do in the past, though. This is definitely a market improvement.
Well, and the point is it's Facebook, right? So they have a huge store of photos to draw mm-hmm. from.
Absolutely, yeah. A lot of users have upwards of 1,000, 2,000, 5,000 photos.
And wow. So what are they saying it's for? Why are they doing it? Why did they say they're doing it?
So this particular project is actually just a research. They just released a research paper. It's not actually deployed on the website right now. I should say yet, because of course they're going to use it.
Yeah, oh, that's fun. All right, next thing.
Yeah, they'll look at the photos that you upload or that your friends upload, right, and then automatically tag you. There is a creepy factor to that, definitely.
Yeah,
what do you think?
There are photos I have been tagged in where I've contacted the person who tagged me and said, "Could you no?" No, I don't want to be tagged in that photo.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Maybe because I was naked. Possibly. But you know what I mean? Like, I want to be able to decide when I'm identified and when I'm not.
Yeah, definitely.
Embarrassing party? No, thank you.
Well, I know Picasso was doing stuff like this because I was using that for photos for a while, and it would, you know, if I had people in my address book and they had a profile photo and things like that, or if I tagged one, then it would guess all these faces. Are all these people that same person? Let us auto-tag that person for you. Right. But I don't think the percentage accuracy was near human, human accuracy.
Lindsay, is Picasso the Google one?
Yep, that's the Google. Well, Google bought them, I believe.
Got it. Yeah, I was playing around with that a couple of years ago too, mm-hmm. and this technology has been around for a really long time. Facial recognition has been around for quite a while.
So I should have been creeped out much earlier.
Well, I guess so. Like the creepy factor of this isn't news to me, and I guess there's one big reason why. This is just an extrapolation of what's been happening constantly over Facebook's entire life, yeah. Right? If Facebook had respected your privacy the way I would prefer, where it asks you, do you want to share this kind of stuff, this kind of stuff, and that kind
it's
of stuff?
Opt-in.
It's
that's opt-in. What we like. Yeah.
Facebook wouldn't have taken off because when you first join a social network and there aren't many people around, you're not going to share anything. Yeah. And then everyone else who joins won't see that you're on the network and won't see any of the stuff you're sharing because you're not sharing anything. Mm-hmm. And then Facebook dies, like the number of other social networks that we're trying to get off the ground. Yeah. And we would have some other company
Is that what's going on with Google Plus?
With Google?
That's not really taken off. I mean, the joke is that it's for people who work at Google.
And when they launched, they took advantage of the whole backlash about Facebook and privacy and everything.
Yeah.
And they said, no, we have good privacy controls, unlike
Facebook.
That's
what I'm remembering. I'm not sure what's going on with them now because I don't check it out that
much.
Yeah,
but at the same time, they're not entirely opt-in either, you know? I mean, they have to get users and get data in order to survive. So.
Yeah. Well, I still have a manageable heart rate. Let's talk some more about privacy stuff.
Freak Bonnie out more.
Yeah.
Well, the freak out stuff about that also is, like, in Europe, they seem to have really restrictive laws about opt-in. And everyone knows that there's CCTV everywhere and mm-hmm. doesn't want facial recognition incorporated with the CCTV so they know where everyone is all the time.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of people here that freak out about stuff like that when they try to put cameras in at lights, red lights and stuff like
that.
Because there's, less regulation of facial recognition stuff in social software. But I think government will have to comply to certain rules. We'll see.
Oh, I'm sure they'll do it. I'm not worried at all. Yeah.
That's an interesting phenomenon that people over in Europe are a lot more concerned with privacy because their privacy has been... this is a very biased way of putting it, but their privacy has been trodden on already in a lot of very obvious ways. There are cameras everywhere, and so everyone's aware of it, unlike here, maybe. It's kind of a reverse.
We can feel like we're going about our business, but in fact, people are keeping track.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And reading emails when they want to.
Yeah, speaking of which. Microsoft has revised their privacy policy recently, and that was kind of in response to a public outcry after they accessed somebody's a private user's Hotmail account. Mm-hmm. Now, if you sign up for Hotmail, you're basically agreeing to this because it's part of the user agreement mm-hmm. that under certain specific circumstances they can access your account to get data. And people sign that stuff, they check the box, and they don't realize what they're actually signing up for until a big news story comes out like this. So last week, ex-Microsoft employee was accused of sending Microsoft proprietary source code to a blogger. Mm. Now, the blogger sent the source code to an unnamed person, hoping to verify that it was legitimate, but that person tipped off Microsoft to what was going on instead of verifying.
Okay. Mm.
So there's, a big court hearing going on.
Yeah.
But as part of the investigation, they accessed the person's Hotmail account to get information, the blogger's emails that were sent back and forth to this ex-Microsoft employee.
That's okay. No good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they've revised their privacy policy, but they haven't said, we're not going to do that anymore. Right. But this is one case out of, lots of different things that go on. And so they're saying, well, this is kind of the one case where we have the right to do things like that because they're saying that it would have put
users
at risk because this person was stealing registry keys for registering products.
Yeah.
And then the code that was sent was supposedly how to activate versions of Windows and things like that.
Uh-huh.
But, there's not specific information released yet. I'm sure more will come out as the time goes on.
Mm.
But the way they modified the privacy policy is... They said that they won't conduct a search of customer email and other services unless the circumstances would justify a court order. Now, it's kind of vague what would justify a court order.
Unless we decide that it's justified.
Right. And so in the past, people were upset saying, well, you're the ones that are deciding whether it justifies a court order. So now, as part of this new privacy policy, they have an external third party judge and legal team deciding whether or not something would justify a court order.
All right. So we're aware of things. What do you guys think? Is that going to be a good improvement on the privacy, the sense of privacy that people have and the actual privacy that people have?
I can't, you know, personally, I don't know enough about the legal stuff to be able to say whether it would be legit or not. You know, as I think a lot of this is just to calm users, a little bit of PR mode. But
okay, it's kind of a TSA thing.
Yeah, I say not good enough. Like, if you're gonna change your privacy policy in response to a situation like this, the new privacy policy should say we aren't gonna do it or something to that effect.
Yeah.
It shouldn't like no, that's not good enough.
We'll be slightly more discriminating.
Yeah, it's like saying oh, okay, I won't do it. I won't do it next time, but we'll be more careful. What does that mean?
Yeah, it's kind of like that general. Oh, don't worry. We will only do this if you're a bad guy. So if you're not a bad guy, you
then
get
you don't
to feel
have to
safe.
Worry about it. Yeah.
But mm-hmm. then it's like the basic who decides who's a bad guy and who's not.
Yeah, you don't have anything to hide, right?
No.
Yeah,
I'm
so.
Not sure. All right. So what can people do when email is not as private as we think? First of all, who thinks it's really that private?
Well, that's, you know, the general assumption for non-technical people is you just get in the habit of sending emails and you don't think every time you send an email, oh my gosh, the world could read this at some point or some person behind a desk at some company could read this. I think it's just a complacency, you know, so you don't have to be paranoid at all times.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was thinking about that the other day. Where's the secure email version? And there are places that do secure email, but you know, the more secure you get, the less user-friendly things are.
The more in the know you have to be, how to maneuver in the virtual world.
And enterprises use secure email a lot of times, but users just sending stuff back and forth don't necessarily. But you'd think if you were this blogger posting technical information that you would about Microsoft that you wouldn't use your Hotmail account to send the information.
You would kind of think that. First of all, how cute.
We talk about Hotmail account. Privacy, though. I mean, is it privacy from external people or is it privacy from everybody, right?
Mm.
Can Microsoft read your Hotmail account? That's a completely different question than how do you secure your email account from attackers or something like that.
Right, I could say.
And then also another thought about the whole, is your email private? I think that people truly believe it is. People truly believe that their phone calls were private.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there was recently a story, I'm not going to cover it today, but just basically that the NSA has a system capable of recording 100% of a foreign country's telephone calls.
Yeah.
And in the story, they don't say what foreign country, of course, and there's all this yada yada. But I mean, that's really intense, you know? Mm-hmm. So if you're in, just making up a country, if you're in Belgium or something, you wouldn't ever imagine like, oh yeah, the United States is definitely recording me right now.
Right.
That's weird.
Mm-hmm.
And I really don't think that users don't see their phrased the opposite way without a double negative. It seems like users wouldn't think that they are being monitored all the time.
Mm-hmm.
When sometimes that's the case.
Unless you listen to Geek Speak once a week and get your hit of paranoia.
Oh, boy.
Well, some people are working on this, right, of making things a little more secure, Ben?
Well, yeah, the technical security part. There's this thing called two-factor authentication. Just in a nutshell, basically, instead of saying, I have an email account and nobody can get into it because nobody knows my password.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what if Lindsay sees me typing my password? Then Lindsay can get into my email account, right? There's two-factor authentication, which is all about something that you know and something that you have. Both. That's the two factors. So if I have two-factor authentication on my Gmail account and Lindsay gets my password, then she can type in my password, but the second factor of authentication would be texting my phone or something.
Okay.
And so she would have to have access to my phone as well, something I have and something that I know in order to get it in my account. So that's really, really important, and a lot of companies have been implementing it, and a lot of notable companies have not been implementing it, such as banks or places that you would shop, right?
Yeah.
Like Amazon doesn't have it, and that's actually pretty, that was surprising to me, considering how poised they are for world takeover. You'd think that they'd throw a couple engineers on this problem.
Yeah.
So there is a two-factor authentication database. I'm going to post the link up on geekspeak.org. Basically, this guy went through and tried to figure out what companies have two-factor authentication and what don't.
Is this a cloud-based database?
Well, it's just a website. It's a website, okay. And it says, let's say GitHub. GitHub has SMS two-factor authentication, Google Auth, and Authy two-factor authentication, and then here's the link to their page on it, you know?
Oh, I see. It's a list of good places to go where they do have two-factor authentication.
Yeah, and beyond that, there's also a link for the ones that don't have it that says tell them to support two-factor authentication. You can click on it and tweet them and say, hey, this is important to me. And so I did that to a couple of companies and didn't receive any responses.
Well, no, it's the power of numbers, right? So we're going to have a link to that at geekspeak.org, right? So people can look that up and
you got a bit after the show.
Informed citizens. Okay. So stay tuned. In just a bit, geekspeak.org will be chock-a-block with useful information for you. And it's Geek Speak here on KUSP. Next time on another great show, which is called the 7th Avenue Project, which you can hear Sundays at high noon here on 88.9 KUSP, physicists got some stunning news from the South Pole this week. A remote telescope detected evidence of the cosmos as it was almost 14 billion years ago. It's the earliest glimpse yet of our universe and opens a new window on cosmic history. Cosmologist Anthony Aguirre joins KUSP's Robert Pauly to explain the discovery and what it means for science on the 7th Avenue Project. That's Sunday at noon here on 88.9 KUSP. And if you're listening to this on the webs, go to our website, kusp.org, and find the story there by clicking on the 7th Avenue Project on the left-hand side there. Well, so this is Geek Speak on 88.9 KUSP. By the way, Rick Philman is in the other room awaiting your calls. If you have anything you'd like to weigh in about the stories you're hearing about today, call us toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch in the host chair, and with me in the air room is Ben Jaffe and Lindsay Lonnie. Ben, you're just back from India, right?
Yes, I am. And it was a really fun trip. It was 2.5 weeks. I do have to say briefly, the 7th Avenue Project, that was a really awesome discovery that was just made.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm really excited for that show.
It's going to be a great show. So, in Robert's hands, we're going to hear everything. Yeah. We're going to hear it all. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, geeks, take note. That's going to be a very special geeky 7th Avenue Project tomorrow.
So, yeah, I just got back from India. And of course, whenever I travel, I notice geeky things here and there.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed a couple really cool things in India. First of all, that I wouldn't have thought it, but India has a very, what I would call a hacker culture, right? When I say a hacker culture, it's kind of a do-it-yourself culture, a find-a-way-to-make-it-work culture.
Oh, kind of makery, intuitive makers.
Yeah, a there's not one right way culture, right?
Okay.
So an example of that is we were buying a cell phone charger, me and my partner, and the power was out in this little shack.
Okay.
And so, you know, they climbed up on the side of the building and their connection to the power grid was just two hooks of wire. They'd bent the wire into a hook and just like put
it
up on
set it on there.
Yeah. And apparently it wasn't connecting right. So they got up there with a wrench, an insulated wrench, so they didn't get zapped.
Yeah.
And they just kind of like whacked it a couple times to get the power to come back on. And it worked, you know?
And it worked, yeah. And it worked. Power.
And then the power went off again, and they got back up there and whacked it a couple times. And, I mean, maybe not the most efficient solution. They didn't have specialized connectors. They didn't have a licensed electrician connecting their shack up to the power grid. But it worked, you know?
They were getting themselves some power. I wonder if they were paying for it.
Yeah.
Like, how do you bill for that?
I do not know. But there's so many of those things that I found in India, similar with traffic patterns, you know? Like, in America, we have very strict rules about when you can change lanes, don't cut people off, all that stuff. In India, it just felt like everybody just get yourself in there, push everybody out of the way and do that. And yet, at first, it looks chaotic. At first, it looks like, how does this work? How could this possibly work? Yeah. We're going to die. We're going to crash. But it's like there's this underlying order to things. like what I actually thought of is when I was a kid, I used to break off little pieces of leaves and put them in the gutter as the water ran down.
Oh, and then you watch how they sort of clump together and eddy. And
they clump together, but also they pass each other and they kind of swirl around each other in this beautiful way. Yeah. And I imagine like if I couldn't see the water and I just saw the leaves, it's like there's something underlying this intuition that everybody has the same intuition.
That's the word I was looking for.
Yeah. Or this subluminous ether for the astronomy geeks, you know? this thing that everything flows through. Yeah. And somehow everybody gets where they're going. Huh. And get me wrong, there are traffic jams, but many fewer than I thought. And there are traffic accidents, but many fewer than I thought.
Yeah. Given that amount of case, that you'd be seeing people just crashing into
each other. I thought I would have died like five times, you know?
Okay, well, I'm glad you're still with us then.
Yeah, it was so much fun.
What do you think about that, Lindsay?
Well, it reminds me of, have you seen those videos of all the birds flying together?
Oh,
and
yeah.
The fish flying together in formation, and it looks like the same kind of thing. Maybe there's some inherent thing that we all do intuitively.
Possibly. Yeah. Well, the way we set things up here, there's not hope for that kind of, intuitive clumping. We regulate everything.
Yeah, and sometimes to our detriment. Actually, one quick story also. I was at IHOP yesterday morning getting crepes.
The International House of Pancakes, for those of you who are suffering from acronyms.
I don't know. I just really wanted pancakes.
Yeah, they're delicious.
Or crepes. So so I asked, can I get this veggie crepe that has ham in it, basically? Mm-hmm. Can I get that, but with spinach instead of ham? And I thought, of course they're going to do that. Spinach costs less than ham, probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they said no. And they wouldn't let me buy it. And so I said, okay, well, never mind then. We'll split one crepe. And they walked away and they made less money. Now, that didn't make any sense to me. Like, why wouldn't they want to make that crepe? And I think it's because in India, I guess, there are these guidelines, not so much regulations and rules as much as guidelines. And people just follow them. But then if they're in a situation like that, they'll say, no, wait. Okay, fine. That's totally fine because I'm still going to make money off of you, you know? Yeah. Like,
they can make decisions in the specific.
It's an optimization game.
Oh, yeah.
In America, it's following the rules. Mm-hmm. And some restaurants have rules for their menu that are internally consistent, and some have internally inconsistent rules.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's just really cool, you know? Like, it permeates the entire culture.
Right, wow.
I've encountered with restaurants like IHOP where there's a set of rules and they're not supposed to deviate, that you can have individuals who will force a deviation of the rules. Whereas it seems like, you know, what you're saying is in India that's the norm, is that people will deviate from the rules or consider the rules to be more as just guidelines.
And at which point is it a deviation?
Is that, you know, the rules are the rules and it's a unique individual that deviates from the guidelines.
Well, okay.
Being a geek, I drive my parents crazy whenever I go to breakfast because I'm always trying to find a way to game the menu.
Oh, you're one of those.
Yeah.
Every wait person's delight.
Just order, Ben. Just order. We're hungry.
You're driving more than your parents crazy when you're
you're Meg Ryaning at the restaurant.
I'm not that bad.
Okay. Oh. All right.
Well, and then how would that work? Let's just apply that principle.
Yeah.
To the 600 megahertz band.
Yes.
It's time to light the TV. Yeah.
This is radio waves and all that stuff, right?
Yeah.
Not exactly. Music.
Not music. Yeah.
Airwaves. 600 megahertz band.
So they're kind of up for grabs.
Kind of, yeah.
So what's going on with that, Lindsay?
Next year, the FCC will ask TV broadcasters to give up some of their airwaves in the 600 megahertz band so that they can be auctioned off to wireless mobile phone carriers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure other people can bid in the auction, but, you know, wireless carriers are going to be the main bidders.
We're watching TV more on our phone, kind of makes sense in one way.
Yeah, they're saying that as the future goes, that more people are going to be using the wireless bands than the TV bands. So, you know, if you think about your gadgets, more and more you're going to be moving towards wireless when you're watching TV and doing different things like that.
Mm.
So those TV carriers, broadcasters that give up their bandwidth voluntarily will get some of the auction proceeds. So there's going to be their trade-off. And those that don't give it up voluntarily will be moved to another part of the spectrum most likely.
Hmm.
So these 600 megahertz, this is called beachfront realty
prime real estate.
Yeah, exactly. They're some of the most valuable airwaves that will ever in the foreseeable future be available to wireless providers.
Okay.
And the reason for that is that the 600 band travels farther than frequencies above 1,000 megahertz. So it can penetrate buildings, navigate hilly terrain, go through vegetation, and all that makes these less likely to lose connection compared to those traveling on higher bands. And they're also cheaper to operate because they require fewer towers.
So when this is a precious, precious commodity, if we were working with India's model of I'll just haggle my way into a good deal,
yes,
then would there be room for everyone to have access to that band?
And that's the big debate that's going on right now, is the smaller carriers, you know, like Sprint and T-Mobile, they want everyone to be able to bid and have access to this, whereas the larger carriers like Verizon and AT&T are lobbying in Washington right now to try and, the Verizon and AT&T want to be able to have access to everything, whereas the smaller carriers want to have limitations set on what you can bid on. Otherwise, the larger carriers are going to be able to buy everything up, and they're not going to have a chance. Yeah. And then, you know, who knows if they'll have a future after that,
right,
if this is the way things are going. Yeah, right now, the smaller carriers have the majority of real estate in the higher frequencies, which means that they're great for urban areas, unless you're right in the center of a large building, in which case you might not be able to get a signal through there. But like if you look at maps, and the article I'll post up on the website has maps that shows coverage of the various carriers, and the larger carriers cover the rural areas really well, so you can drive across the country and still get connectivity, whereas if you have smaller carriers, you're going to have spotty connectivity away from urban areas usually.
Okay.
So regulation, less regulation, more regulation.
Exactly.
See, that's one where I would say regulation, good.
Yeah, I would agree.
Well, in the past, you know, the government stepped in order to keep the two major carriers from having a monopoly. And so we're going to see with the auction next year whether or not they're going to do that again, because Verizon and AT&T are dumping millions and millions of dollars
they're spending
in Washington.
You know, if you're looking for a way to earn a good dollar, become a lobbyist.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Who's making out in Washington? I think those must be the guys.
Yeah, I was kind of astonished that AT&T is number 11 on the money in Washington list as far as lobbying goes.
Yeah.
Of, like, all companies, not just wireless companies.
Really?
But all. And Verizon's number 18 as far as giving money up there.
That's pretty high.
Okay. Powerful. Powerful stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what else is powerful and much smaller?
What's that?
Those mosquitoes.
Oh.
They
buzzing
are.
Around your ear.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
This is my idea of a segue.
All right.
So I'll bring this back, but have you guys heard of the inverse square law?
No.
It's basically, if you have, let's say you have a loudspeaker, or you have a light bulb or something like that, the further away you go, obviously you're going to get less light or you're going to hear less sound. And that relationship is an inverse square relationship. So you get twice as far away and you get one quarter the amount of sound. That's why it's really hard to hear mosquitoes until they're right up next to you.
Oh, is that right? What's going on there?
So that's why you get all these bites in your feet and you never heard them. Stop it.
Oh, my gosh.
Bonnie.
Wicked, wicked.
I am evil.
Yeah, yeah. I had a flashback there.
Yeah. So they're hard to sense in your presence until they're literally in your face.
And there's nothing worse than waking up around 2 a.m. because of jet lag in India and you hear one mosquito just flying around, getting closer, further away.
Yeah.
And of course, you're like in that weird zone between sleep and awakeness. So you're thinking, this definitely has malaria. I'm definitely going to die. Right?
Oh, yeah.
So,
but not all mosquitoes do, right?
I mean,
there's some entire species of mosquito that aren't carriers.
Yes, that's definitely true. And also, only one of the sexes bites, actually. I'm pretty sure it's the females, right, that bite?
Females always bite.
Remember
that. Menfolk, be afraid of all lady forms.
And the male mosquitoes just kind of hang around. So if we were to try to eliminate malaria entirely, we would have to target basically all of the female mosquitoes of certain types of mosquitoes, which tend to carry malaria. And if you get rid of all those mosquitoes, aside from feeling really bad about the genocide you just got...
Sorry about the mosquito genocide.
You could potentially eradicate malaria, at least from mosquitoes,
okay,
right? So there are a couple steps to do that. One of them is you need to be able to identify the mosquitoes, right? And The problem right now is we don't really have a very big dictionary, a really big data set of the types of mosquitoes. One of the ways that... No.
I'm surprised.
Because of the infrasquare law. Because, so, one really easy way to tell what kind of mosquito you have, aside from, like, you know, putting it in a freezer so it stops moving and looking at it really closely, that's not feasible, right? So, instead, you can listen to the exact sound that the wings make, and if they flap at a certain... a certain frequency, that's this type of mosquito.
Are you serious? They all flap differently?
They all flap a little bit differently, apparently.
Those guys are so small, first of all.
Yeah.
And they sound the same. So this is where tech comes in, right? Because obviously the human ear is not going to be capable of discerning those subtle distinctions.
So imagine a researcher running around the room following this mosquito with a microphone, trying to get close enough that you can figure out what the frequency is. That's just silly. And that's actually one of the reasons that we have such a small database of the kinds of mosquitoes.
Because you have to capture them and have them in a small enough chamber that you can get the microphone in there.
Yeah, well, partially that and just... Yeah, it's complicated. Well, there's actually a new way of doing it. Basically, instead of using a microphone, which captures sound vibrations by moving a little diaphragm and you know the way microphones work, and then having the problem of the inverse square law, they're too far away. Mm. Instead of doing that, if you were to shine a little laser beam or some kind of light through the mosquito's wings, then you would see on the other end less light, more light, less light, more light, as the mosquito wings go up and down and up and down.
Oh, so you use light to... Oh.
Exactly. So you can do that, and if you just put a sensor on one end and you put a little low-power laser thing flying over, going across on the other end, then you can actually pretty adequately figure out the beat frequency.
Okay. Hmm. Boy, it just comes down to such technical, you know, but kind of practical stuff.
Yeah, it's all the same techniques, though. I mean, you know, so instead of the wings moving the air, which moves the diaphragm, which creates a voltage, which then you record, you just shine a laser at the mosquito and you see the light change. So there it is.
There it is.
Because that's what's causing the sound.
You know. I wonder if you could, you know, like at the entrance of your home or building, you've got some two-sided thing that sits across your doorway, you know, and you get as a mosquito flies through, it's alarming. It sets
warning.
Some alarm when the malaria mosquito flies
malaria inside.
Warning, malaria, warning.
It'll tell you exactly what kind it is.
There's actually, there's all this wacky technology for killing mosquitoes, actually. Yeah. I think the Bill and Melinda...
Build a mosquito trap.
Yeah, I read that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation put a lot of money into this because it's malaria. It kills a lot of people.
Yeah.
And it's something that's a fairly low-hanging fruit, it seems, as opposed to, you know, AIDS or HIV or anything like that.
Yeah.
And so there's this technology where you have a mosquito net, and as the mosquitoes crawl on the mosquito net to try to get in to bite you, their legs get cut off.
Oh my gosh.
Which is like terrifying. There's also this little box that has a laser inside, and it'll actually shoot the mosquitoes out. Mosquito gone. It's
very elaborate, you know.
Crazy, like all these things. And
well,
all...
that shows our sort of long-standing, enduring hatred of mosquitoes that we're willing to put that much technology into offing them poor little guys.
We don't have a lot of things that can prey upon us anymore, but that's one of them.
But those guys manage it.
Yes, and they're sneaky about it.
And
you know?
The pills you take to inoculate yourself are very expensive, especially the ones that don't have side effects. They're like $10 a pill or something ridiculous like that.
Yeah, that's a lot.
So if you go to India and you get the more expensive, less side effect medication, that's like one pill or an entire day in India living. You know, living opulently or something.
Relatively, yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, we've got a couple of minutes before our break, and I'm wondering how many geek bits we can get through.
These are
the visual things, right? Here we are on a radio show, but still we insist on talking about visual things.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. So do you want to start us off, Lindsay?
Sure. So have you seen these sticky tape selfies? So
no.
There's
wait. So I know selfie, right? That's I take a picture of myself.
Exactly.
So when I think sticky tape selfie, I think printing them onto sticky tape.
Well, it's a little more interesting than that, if you ask me. I think it is.
Okay.
Maybe a matter of perspective.
Is this like packing tape stuff?
They're calling it sticky tape or cello tape because there's a brand, cello, that makes some of the tape.
Okay.
But it's basically like masking tape, you know, that you have at a desk at work. And people
but
are
clear.
Wrapping it. Yeah, it's clear.
Okay.
And they're wrapping it around their faces and distorting their facial features to look like a Picasso painting.
What?
And so they're posting these pictures on the internet for everyone to see.
So lumpy faces.
Yes, exactly.
It's okay, what?
Interesting yet hideous. And we will
post
some
to believe it.
On geekspeak.org.
Okay, so sticky tape selfies. All right, and what else?
12-track digital sequencer. Mm. So it's actually kind of an art installment, but I thought it was really fascinating. Somebody took a 12-track digital sequencer and put 12 analog music boxes attached to it, and you can use the knobs on the sequencer to control the speed of the music boxes and make music with this.
Oh,
so there's
digital
a video
analog.
Of how it works, and it's a cacophony when you turn start turning everything up. It would be hard to make actual music unless you made custom music boxes with
but that's the
notes,
next step clearly
but that would be the next step exactly.
Okay, so some potential fun there. And Ben, you got one?
Yeah, I have a 3-second one. It's a Rubik's Cube. It's a Lego robot that solves a Rubik's Cube in a record time, and it actually solves it in
pop culture double win.
I know. So 3.253 seconds.
Wow.
About 3.25 seconds.
And no Legos go flinging off the robot.
No. Apparently,
they must have.
This thing twists the Rubik's Cube so fast, they must have glued a lot of this stuff together. Like,
yeah.
But it's really cool to watch for about 3.253 seconds. And then you're like, that was it? God. Oh, okay. Well, 3 seconds isn't a very long time.
No.
So watch this video, and it'll be really. You'll want to see this really epic, climactic thing.
Yeah.
But it'll be like.
We're just letting you know right now it's going to be anticlimactic.
Yeah.
Still check it out at geekspeak.org.
They should slow it down and give us a clear window.
Watch mine first and then watch Lindsay's to be wowed even more, right?
Okay, so that's the good order.
The
you don't end with an anticlimax. End maybe with this, sticky tape.
It is pretty cool, though.
So watch them in reverse order. We'll just have to post them in reverse order at the website after the show.
Yep.
All right. Do we have time for a couple PSAs?
Sure.
There's things going on that you should know about out there.
The EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, every year puts out Reporters Without Borders, who are, I think, affiliated with the EFF, put out a short guide to the internet's biggest enemies.
Oh.
And that's countries. That's.
Oh, those are big. Yeah.
Yeah, that's... Wow, that's funny. Russia is on the list, actually. It's a newcomer. And it's this big long list of countries that either like limit online speech or control online discourse, censorship, whistleblower treatment, all that stuff. For the first year, the United States is on that.
Oops.
And although the United States does a lot of great things for promoting internet freedom and all that stuff,
the NSA ding on the record.
The NSA surveillance and the whistleblowers thing.
Oh, yeah. That does kind of affect one's reputation out there in the world.
Yeah, so they're on that. So is the UK. And
thanks, Angela Merkel.
Yeah, great.
Let's blame her. All right, and Lindsay, you've got a PSA for us.
I sure do. This is just a reminder that you can do a couple of simple things to help protect your router from being hacked.
Mm-hmm.
If your router is hacked, you'll see stuff like fake search results, hijacking of your browser, malware, things like that. You know, all those pop-up windows that come up.
Mm-hmm.
The easiest things to do is check the model number and pull up your router's manual online, and then follow the instructions to, number one, update the firmware, two, turn on wireless encryption, WPA2 if it's available, and then provide a strong password. And number three, turn off SSID or network name broadcasting so that you can only access it if you know the network name.
Okay, so there's things you can do step by step to protect yourself in that way. And if that sounded like a bit much just to listen to as a one pass through, don't worry about it. We're going to have a link to it at geekspeak.org after the show.
Yeah, people need to be walked through things like this. I mean, I feel like I need to be walked through things like this. You know?
Me too. It's Geek Speak here on 88.9 KUSP and KUSP.org. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch in the host chair today, talking with Ben Jaffe and Lindsay Lonnie. And something's going on in Turkey. I heard about this on the news. They're trying to do a Twitter ban, but no one seems to be paying attention or something. What's going on with that, Lindsay?
Well, people are definitely paying attention, but So Twitter was banned. Basically what happened last week is that there was a political corruption scandal that broke out involving the prime minister, where videos and audio were released on Twitter with him talking to his son about things like how to hide large sums of money and stuff like that.
Oh.
He claims that it was faked, that those are not real, and blames social media for blemishing their public image, and that it's damaging to the people of Turkey to have this happen.
Oh yeah.
So he threatened to shut down Twitter, and initially, before threatening to shut down Twitter in Turkey, they issued a legal statement saying, "Hey, you guys need to remove this stuff, Twitter. We don't want this out in the public eye." Mm. And Twitter didn't do anything. So that's when they actually did the ban.
Yeah.
And so I think there's like 79 million people in Turkey or something like that, and nobody could access the Twitter site.
Mm.
And so it had the opposite effect, as you may have imagined, where instead of people going, "Oh, okay, yeah, we won't access Twitter, those guys are bad," they're like, "Hey, wait a minute, you're telling us we can't access social media?" So there's been sort of a grassroots movement, and there's, you know, things like graffiti saying DNS 8.8.8.8, which is...
Oh, that's what that was about.
Yeah.
Someone put that in my Facebook feed, and I didn't get it. I didn't know what was going on there.
Yeah.
But it was that activism in Turkey to give people access to...
Right.
Okay.
So they found two major workarounds, and one was posted up on the Twitter site saying that you could use SMS to post Twitter messages instead of, you know, going through the site.
Okay.
And the other one is this DNS. If you use that, which is one of Google's DNS, then you can get around it and go ahead and post. So
nice.
There's a lot of political posters are now having this spray painted across them and stuff like that. So there's some interesting
people of Turkey
are
putting up with
happening. Basically, the tweets have risen by 138%.
Oh, since that didn't work.
This happened, yeah.
Nope.
And, you know, the hashtags Twitter is blocked in Turkey and Turkey blocked Twitter became the two top trending tags around the world.
You know, what you resist sticks to you. It's just a universal truth.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, we've got someone on the line who's looking for some recommendations. Let me make sure that I do all the parts right here. Mardine, are you there?
Yes, I am.
What recommendations are you looking for?
I am looking for the best way to create a calendar that I can share with other people so that they can access it on either their computer, their phone, their Android, whatever media they're using, and be able to add events and, you know, we can all see the same calendar.
Oh, you know, people have been thinking about this in advance of you, and we have a couple recommendations.
Google, all right, cool.
Yeah, Google Calendar. Google has a really great calendar service. You can create public calendars, and you can change what certain individuals can do and what the public can do. You can have people be able to add events, remove events, change events, and all that stuff.
I'll stop you because I actually tried that.
You did?
Oh, you've tried Google. Okay.
Yeah. And I put their email addresses in and made them, able to edit and change the events and all that. And it said that it would send them an email, but none of them got it. And I couldn't figure out how to make it do that and actually send them the email with the link to the calendar.
Hmm.
And then when I tried several different ways of doing that, and they did eventually get an email, but it didn't have a link to the calendar. They never saw the calendar.
Are you going from the function within Google Calendar, like here's a listing and here's who I want to share it with, or?
Yeah, there's a button that says share this calendar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I clicked on that and I entered all their email addresses.
Well, I'll tell you, if you've added all their email addresses as email addresses that can edit the calendar, you should theoretically just be able to send them a link manually. Now, you shouldn't have to do that, but if for some reason the emailing feature isn't working or something like that, you should be able to send them the direct link. Just send them the URL to the calendar. And if they visit it and they're signed in using their account, then they should be able to make all the edits and stuff.
We might be seeing something here that's not about how Google Calendar functions, but how maybe your computer interacts with Google Calendar, maybe?
Hmm.
I don't know. What do you think, guys?
I think that the Google Calendar and a lot of the Google services are really targeted for people using Gmail email addresses. And they do make it available for those that don't. But sometimes there's, you know, a little less user-friendliness to it.
So it might be the fact that do the other folks have Gmail accounts, or are they using other email providers?
They don't all have Gmail accounts. And the one thing that it did do was send them an invitation to join, to set up a Gmail account.
Of course.
Right. Yeah.
So some of them did, and yet they still couldn't access the calendar. So
okay. Well, there's a Lifehacker page with the 5 best calendaring apps. I'll try to find a more recent one. They had one that they did a couple of years ago, and they've done a recent one on Android apps like Business Calendar. But I'll post a link up on the site with something comparing different calendar applications. It's hard to find one that's cross-platform that you can use on both iPhone and Android. So
yeah,
you might have to use something different, or just have a web-based or cloud-based calendar that everyone accesses through their phone's browser. But we'll take a look.
So, Mardine, take a look at geekspeak.org after the show. We're going to move on, but we'll look up something relevant for you and give you some other options to try.
Cool. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Bye.
Bye. All right. Well, what Mardine did was call us at 800-655-5877. And if you'd like to weigh in about any of the topics we're talking about today, feel free to call that number. Rick's happy to field you to us. And there's lots more to talk about. Now, you've listed as something that you'd like to talk about Spark Fun and Fluke multimeters, and I don't know what those words mean.
So Spark Fun, a lot of electronics hobbyists know them because they're a hobbyist electronics retailer. Oh. What they do is they sell you different parts that you might use in your electronic hobby parts.
They're like Heathkit, but different.
Yeah, and they're an awesome company. I really like them, and I really respect them. So they recently had U.S. Customs send them a letter saying that a shipment of 2,000 of their multimeters that they had ordered was being barred from entry into the country. Mm.
And can you just explain what a multimeter is for those who don't know?
It doesn't really matter. I'll just say it's a thing that does electronic things.
It measures stuff.
Yeah, it's a measuring device, right?
Okay.
So that's the key. And the electronic multimeters that they were importing had kind of an orange-yellow trim on them.
Okay.
Apparently, there is a company called Fluke, and Fluke has a patent for a... Now, this is where it gets a little fuzzy, because when you read patents that were given a while ago, they can be exceptionally broad.
Yeah.
So you could interpret this patent as a measuring device with yellow on it, or with yellow around the
edge. And this is part of what's wrong with patents and the trademark process, is that it's possible for people to submit these incredibly vague patents, and then they can sue you if you fall into their broad category.
Exactly. Now, this is not, excuse me, this was not Fluke's doing. This was U.S. Customs. And from what I can tell, not very many people have positive things to say about customs, right?
Yeah.
Whether they're individual travelers or whether they're importing goods.
Yeah.
The problem here is that they didn't really have much recourse. They couldn't send it back to the country it was manufactured in because of import tariffs. They couldn't get it into the States to sell them or even to donate them because of the patent thing. It reminds me of one time when I was going through the agricultural check and I had a banana in my hand.
Mm-hmm.
And they wouldn't let me through with the banana. It was my breakfast. There was no one in the entire area, and they wouldn't let me eat the banana or walk back from where I went.
You couldn't even eat the banana?
No, I had to throw it away.
Boo!
So, you know, it's kind of that situation.
Yeah.
So basically they said, all right, well, we don't really have – they wrote a blog post about this, and they said, we don't have any time to decide what happens because we're paying $150 a day for storage,
right,
which sucks. And then also they have to pay $150 per hour for destroying the 2,000 units. That's bad news. So boo customs, basically.
Yeah.
So they sent a message to the company Fluke. They basically said, you're cool, we like Fluke, and we didn't know about your trademark, and we agree to change our colors. Can you give us a 60-day license so we can bring these in and then give them to a charity of your choice?
Oh, elegant workaround.
And then in addition to that, they were just going to eat the $30,000 that they would be losing, you know, $30,000 plus the destruction cost. So Fluke responded and one-upped their awesomeness
And they basically said, all right, sure. Yeah, you can bring these in and we'll donate them. And we're going to give you more than $30,000 of our multimeters, which have the yellow trim, not the yellow-orange trim.
Right.
And you can sell them.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So basically, they took on the financial burden that that Spark Fund was going to have to endure. So this is kind of like, okay, the system sucks, but gosh, other people can be really good sometimes.
Yeah.
It's a really feel-good, positive story.
Well, it kind of brings us back to India, right? It is possible in some instances to, you know, haggle some sort of workaround even when the regulations imply that that wouldn't be possible.
Yes.
Win.
So I have so much respect for Spark Fund and for Fluke, and so much less respect for U.S. Customs.
There we go.
And, you know, that's the conservation of respect.
That's
right?
10 geek bonus points each to Spark Fund and Fluke.
Woohoo.
Very nice. Boy, you know, we've only got like a minute left. What should we talk about?
Ooh.
Something good.
Well, let me skip down here because there's a thing about wood skyscrapers I'll put up there, but that would take too long.
Oh, the runway. Can you talk about the runway?
Let's talk about the runway. So San Francisco Airport is using what's called an EMAS, which is an engineered material arresting system, at the end of a couple of its runways. And it's basically concrete with a bunch of air bubbles in it. So when the plane hits the end of the runway, if it's, you know, lost its brakes or something like that, it just sinks into the concrete and stops there.
Oh.
It's a way to comply with some regulations. And they're working on that this year.
It's like
spongy
the runaway truck ramps in the Grapevine, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Nice. All right. So there's hope there for tech in the materials world as well. Well, this has been GeekSpeak for March 22nd, 2014. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, so you reuse our stuff any way you like. Just tell them the geeks say hi. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online.